here I am, September 9th, 1997, asking the Evergreens about these issues.
This session, I'd like to talk to several people. Are those people aware that I'm waiting to be talked to?
Yes.
Is there one particular person who'd like to speak first?
No, please begin.
All right. All right, I would like to begin with Marshall McLuhan. Can you locate him?
Yes.
Marshall, we had a conference in your name last March 21st and 22nd up at York University. What did you think of the overall performance of the speakers?
Two points on adequacy. There is some interesting progression and a more of an understanding moving towards formula, but at the same time not looking at some certain practicalities, putting this at a practical point, seeing what is happening in communications as an overall, not completely realizing that a certain watershed of where communications link together, so forming a totality, that is not as understood as it is to describe various factions or fractions of communications technologies. But on the whole, it's interesting to see where it's going. And it's also interesting to see that there is good addition, good extension of proposition. On the whole, very interesting.
Yeah, for me, I had a reading talk to you a year ago in 96, and you emphasized the fact your work was a science, not an art. The art aspect was not as significant as the science. So I interpret what you're saying now as emphasizing the science applicability of it, that, and most people haven't realized this.
Exactly.
Does Eric, your son, understand this?
He's moving towards it.
So the book, Laws of Media, the New Science, he didn't understand fully.
No, he understands it. But as a measurable state, moving towards measurement is where it must move. If you can measure individual portions of a communications totality, that only work when the portions are fractionalized. But there is less and less fractionalization, more unfractionalization of communications technologies. Where does one end and another begin? Now, certain of these would appear to be obvious, but not so. What is it moving towards? If it is moving towards a communications technology, if it is moving to a great interlinking of communications technologies, then we're moving into more measurability. It would appear that it's easier to measure a radio audience or to measure a television audience. But audiences are now more audiences than were before. And because there are now more audiences, because of greater uses of different fractions of technology, that all of these fractions move towards reassembly of themselves, as though each one is a jigsaw part that eventually becomes connected to another part. And that certain of these are invisible connections, but nonetheless, they become so much more than their antecedents. Telephone is a telephone. A cellular telephone is not a telephone. The fixedness of telephones, the unfixedness of cellular. Now, what is then the telephone? It's one technology, two technologies, a third separate technology. But you cannot have cellular telephones unless there is radio. So the combination of radio, the combination of telephone, is an entirely new methodology. It appears to be an extension of telephone, but in actuality is not. Because telephone can only extend itself towards telephone. There can be better telephone. There can be intriguing telephone. There can be princess phones. But still, these are phones. The cellular is not. Now, some would say that this is just an adaptation of two-way radio, more transportable, more portable because of a certain technology. But you will not have the use of this technology unless there's a need for the technology. Unless there's need, you cannot have any technology. So, what's the need? How did a society reach a certain point where it itself decided it had a need for cellular telephones? So, if you're going to measure all of this, it is measurable. Now, is need measurable? Or is the environment that is created by the communications as it is at present, then that which predicts itself? Can that be measured? What comes after a cellular telephone?
All right, that's very interesting. I was wondering, in this conference they featured Arthur Croker, who represents the postmodern strain of thinking, especially influenced by Jean Baudrillard. You were not aware of Baudrillard's writings and before when you were alive, were you?
Yes and no. Yes, but relevant.
In relative or relevant?
There's always the concept of relevancy. If you would see any description of any system and project forward where that system is going to be, you're going to make some serious mistakes. Because the projection of the system creates something that is not a projection of the system. And every communications systemology has resulted in this phenomenon. Now, his writings, frankly, miss the point.
Yes. Well, what do you think of Arthur Croker's development from Baudrillard?
The development is another thing. The development has to realize what we just said, that you can project, but you're missing the point if you do not understand that the projection is into an environment created by the projection.
Yes. Let's see. So I know Eric objected to Arthur Croker's speech. He said basically it was bullshit. Marshall would agree with his son Eric on that?
Would not be as harsh, but it's a fair description.
Yeah, because... Yes?
Please.
Yeah, it's because he's still working with the idea of being art commentary, talking about relating to the art world and art movements and missing the science fact of it.
Yes. Is this concept of communication an art or a science? If it were art, then there is a different pathway. If it is a speculation about a forthcoming science, then it fits the patterns of the discussion of electricity, as well as the discussions of the concept of radio. Much can be said of the projection of an idea that, and there were movies that were done that would give pictures of 50 years hence, but all of those projections were based upon the existing system refining itself. It did not add in what it itself would create. So art can talk about art, but it cannot talk about science. Now, if communications theory is like economics, finding its rules, finding its basis, and finding that which is repeatable, that which is predictable, then the science of economics and the science of communication would equate. But neither of them are art.
I understand. I'd like to move to a retrospective question about your own work. In Explorations Number 8, the book you put out in 1957, you said that Wyndham Lewis was the first writer to treat media en bloc, E-N-B-L-O-C, French phrase, whereas Joyce and Eliot did it on a smaller scale. Now, many people now talk about the influence of Finnegan's Wake and Joyce on your writings, and they see media in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, but nobody knows about this statement or comments on the fact you're saying Lewis was the first to deal with the media en bloc. Could you clarify that phrase?
Can you understand how Lewis writes? He is not in a pattern of certain other writers. When Lewis wrote, and it would not be his light writing or his heavy writing, but the way that he wrote, it was the difference between the murmuring of a stream and the clash of a cymbal. Now, if you would see that certain writers wrote, and they were almost like streams that rippled and splashed. But C.S. Lewis was a sudden clash of cymbals.
Not C.S. Lewis, Wyndham Lewis.
Wyndham does, yes. Again.
That's what you mean.
Yes.
Clash of cymbals.
Yes, a clash of cymbals. See the difference?
Yes.
Now, Joyce was a high-pressure hose. If you look at that, you'd see that that's an en bloc. You see?
That's Joyce doing en bloc?
That is the rush of a hose. It is the cymbals, not as a crash, like Lewis.
Right.
But as a great sound continuing. The sound of Joyce is continuous through all of the writing. You hear it.
And it's en bloc within that style.
Yes.
So Lewis is en bloc with a clash of cymbals.
Yes.
So what did you mean that Joyce and Eliot did it on a smaller scale, media en bloc?
Smaller is a word that can be adapted.
Yeah.
It is not smaller as in less, but as you would compare a stream trickling down a mountainside and compare that with a high-pressure hose and then move to the next, which would be a clash of cymbals.
I see.
That is where we put smaller, but still that high-pressure forcedness.
Right, and Joyce took the media en bloc and re-amalgamated it within the verbal medium.
Yes.
Whereas Lewis just took on the media as topics in a way. He didn't aesthetically put it back into the word, the verbal medium.
Mm.
Would you agree with that?
Yes.
So in a sense, Lewis, as a topic, was dealt with the new media more obviously, you talking about the BBC and that, whereas Joyce, it was a hidden agenda to refer to the media.
Mm-hmm. Well, by change, did they change the media?
You saying both?
Take, for instance, any of Joyce's work, any, and you put that in front of a person who has not read Joyce before. And then that person reads it. How has that person changed towards the media, the print media?
He or she has changed.
Yes. Now, take a good look around you at various magazines that are available in this year, at 1997. Take a good look. Then take a good look at magazines that were produced in the 20s and the 30s. Take a good look.
Yeah.
And if you take a good look, to suggest Look magazine of the 20s.
Yes.
It smashed the mold, didn't it?
Yes.
It was a visual print media.
Yes.
Now, take a good look at the Saturday Evening Post in the 20s and 30s. Take a good look. Now, move to 1997. Take a good look at Wired magazine. Take a good look at what magazines are. Take a good look, and you'll see that the whole conceptualness of the media has changed. Oh, you can still get a newspaper that looks like a newspaper, but most newspapers are not newspapers. The whole print media has changed. Take a good look, if you would, at a copy of the Wall Street Journal in 1927-28. Take a good look at the Wall Street Journal now, this year, 1997. It has changed, but it has not changed. It has stayed an icon to itself. That is its sales appeal. It's for those who do not want Wired magazine. Now take a good look at any local newspaper in New York, where you are at present, in Toronto, and compare those with their own copies, their own antecedents of 70 years ago. What do you see? Considerable difference. Now, how did Joyce change the book form? For a moment, just look at book. What is the object of book? Obviously, it is put information, story, on consecutive pages. And you start at the beginning, and you read to the end, you close the covers. The book is there, a read book. It is being read. It's not unfamiliar. And people read to be changed. Book changes. But what did Joyce do to the book? Start at the beginning? Finish at the end?
No.
Mm-hmm. So, the book has changed.
Now relate that to Lewis, and since he did he do a similar change in the book media?
He was a contributor. A contributor. They all looked at book differently. But here's another part of book. Book is to be purchased, read, put on a shelf as a red book. That is functional book. Bring in the pocketbook. What have you got? Disposability.
Yeah.
Now, what if you write pocketbook in hardcover? Not that a hardcover would eventually become a particle, but what if you use the thinking? And then would you write differently? How would you write for the media, and how would you change the media?
So Lewis did that. He wrote pocketbook for hardcover?
Yes.
Ah, I see. I'd like to move on to another topic.
Please.
Let's see. I think I'd like to bring in James Joyce for a minute. Can we locate him?
Yes.
Mr. Joyce, why did you focus on the number 1132 in Finnegan's Wake?
Because it wasn't 1133.
Because what wasn't 1133?
1132.
Well, it's used in many different ways. The acceleration of falling object. It's used as a date, 1132 A.D. What was the symbolism of the number, if it had symbolism?
It's a continuity. It's a something that stays there and returns. And it's constantly referenced. It's something to work from, work to, work around.
Is it nothing in itself, then?
Within itself, no.
It's a medium.
It's a hook.
A hook.
And you can do so much with it. You can use it as a date. You can use it as a recipe if you want. But it's... You see, the world is abounds with figures. Do you know how many formula there are? What if there were one formula that covered everything? Well, not that it is true. And what if it could be used to relate to it? Choose any two numbers you want, or any four numbers, or 10 numbers. The other equivalent is E equals MC squared. There's been so much crap written about that, using that as a justification, that 1132 could be used as an equal justification in as many crappy situations.
Well, I was reading an old interview with Ezra Pound, and he seemed to have worked formulaically with ABCD in the wasteland, in the cantos. Was he on the same idea?
No, that's different.
All right. So, was there a reason why you wanted to make this point that you could use all these different relationships evoked by the simple four-number sequence?
Because otherwise it becomes a jumble.
Right, but you were you trying to show a portrait of how a human being's mind organizes data?
Now, if you look at everything is trying to be brought down to a simplicity that can be oftentimes ludicrous. Look at the simplicities that are given. So, the one area that does not have simplicities is various areas of formula. It can become frightening. So, therefore, why not have one formula? Why not have a set of numbers that can stand for everything?
Yes. All right, I would like to ask a personal question. So many Joycean scholars focus on your relationship with your daughter, Lucia. Was she... her mental aberration, whatever happened, that she had to be put away quietly. and not live a normal life. Was that caused by some effect you had on her?
Would that it were. Then it could be examined and solved.
It had a biological cause?
It was biological. It was not caused by a relationship. It could have been improved. It's true. But if that was tried, now, would that it were a cause within the family? Say, quite frankly, that it was caused by a dysfunctionality of the family. Very interesting. But if it were, then surely something could have been done. And do you think that nothing had been tried? This had been tried, that had been tried, none of it successful. But it's so interesting that someone after the fact, not concerned with the circumstances, can so glibly say that it was caused by the environment in which she were. Well, if that is so, would that it were, then it would have been solved.
Yes. Did you have syphilis yourself?
No.
That wasn't the cause of your blindness?
No.
And was the daughter Issy in Finnegan's Wake, your personal problems with her health, is that part of the content of Finnegan's Wake?
You read that portion.
Beg your pardon?
You read that portion.
In Finnegan's Wake.
Yes. And what did you think of it?
I don't know if I've read about that particular part about... Well, I've read about the Issy. I know her part in the book.
Read that part of the book, and you'll see the exasperation. It's all well and good to write things that you can write. But not all things can be righted. There are certain illnesses that defy diagnosis, let alone treatment. And diagnosis in itself is an immature art. So why do you pay for a good doctor's work but a good doctor's diagnosis? And from that good doctor's diagnosis, reach then a situation in which there can be repair. But you can only repair that which you know is broken. And if you do not know which part is broken, then which part do you repair?
Right. Is it true that you saw the same disease, I think, in the Gideons, Siegfried Gideon's daughter or children?
The sameness, but not sameness.
But you warned them, your advice to them helped them not have the same problem?
Yes.
Yeah. Because I read that in early McLuhan writing, but no one else seems to know that story. But it's a true story?
It's a true story. You see, by then, more was known. You see?
Okay. I'd like to move on to another part of this. In your own writing, is it true to say, as Marshall says, that there is no particular personal details of any significance in Ulysses and especially in Finnegan's Wake, that you were writing about the language and media itself and edited out yourself? Is that true?
Somewhat. But you can only see the world from your own eyes. And that is the way of seeing it. Now, not all details are relevant. How a person reaches a conclusion is not necessarily as important as the conclusion itself.
Well,
only to other people who are interested in how conclusions are made does it become then necessary to examine it.
But you were concerned... You're saying one can only see through their own eyes. You did say that, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. You were concerned, though, in Finnegan's Wake, with issues beyond one's own eyes. But is it accurate what George Steiner said, that you were doing this complex act of writing about language as a public medium and the changes on that medium by other media?
Well, that's a very accurate description.
Yes.
But let us take a good look at fish. Do you like fish?
I have to censor the fact whether I like fish or not, so we'll just move it forward here just a second.
Someone does.
Yeah.
Another person is neither here nor there about it. Now you try this experiment. Write something that expresses all three views simultaneously.
Mm.
And where are you going to find yourself? Like, not like, fish-like. You're going to have to play with the language, aren't you?
That's what you did.
Mm. You're going to have to try and put all those three disparate views, contrary to each other, in one passage. Now, take another situation where you would put two like views, but not exactly like views, together. That, when we say that you can only give from your own eyes, but when you stop doing that, then, of course, personal statement disappears. You can only have personal statement if you decide to write something only through your eyes. The world is seen by me. But what if you write, the world is seen by us? And rather than do it as consecutive chapters, first he talks, then the other talks. In chapter one, what Joe sees. Chapter two, what Jack sees. What if you have one chapter which is Jack, Joe sees?
All right, I understand that's what you did in the Wake. What I'm interested in is, where did you get that idea from?
Listening. Everyone has an opinion. And if you get into a bar, get into a situation where there's a few beers flowing, you're going to hear those opinions raised, voice levels raised as these opinions are given.
But that's HCE, Here Comes Everybody.
Mm.
There's your meaning there. But why did you think it was significant to portray that?
Because chapter after chapter after chapter is a brook meandering its way down a mountain. You know it's going to go down because gravity is going to tell it. You know it's going to go this way and that way. It's going to be through a burn here. It's going to be through a little rapid here and so on. It's inevitable. But what if it come at you with a force?
All right, did that happen? Did you see that in the newspaper medium first, or when radio and movies and telephones came in?
No. You see, they all were... they were all the same.
The media?
All the same. Even telephones. Let's see this, one moment. McLuhan says that the telephone became the telephone truly when you could dial up and talk with whom you chose to talk with. The first thing in the telephone was a switchboard.
Yeah.
You could have the receiver and the emitter. But you have to connect this to a switchboard. That's what made the telephone switchboard, which enabled consecutive discussion. First, this person would talk while the other listens. It was exactly the same as all the rest. If you had no switchboard, what would happen? What if everyone talked at once? Cacophony? Babel?
Well, that's what Joyce told earlier to me, that that's what Finnings Wake was, everybody talking at once.
And all of their descriptions, all of their views, all of their contra states, all of their adjoining states. No switchboard. Writing four novels was a switchboard. A gavotte, a dance.
Before switchboards. What was that? Writing before switchboards?
Writing before was switchboard typewriting.
Yeah.
And it was beautifully consecutive, laid out as chapter one, act one, scene one. Exit then to scene two, three. Then it goes on.
Right, I understand.
But if you look at the Greek chorus, the playgoer went to a play where the actors on the stage were being accompanied by a chorus that told the story behind the story, but the actors were not supposed to know that there was a chorus there. So they would act out as all humans would act out in the play. But the Greek chorus would be there telling things to the audience, how that person was now going to step into shit and how that person was going to make a mad mistake in marriage and so on. Now, put that down on paper. If it's happening all at once, the Greek chorus is there telling you as the person is doing it. It would sound without a switchboard. Some people want a switchboard. And some people look at the writing that was done and they would say, well, it makes no sense. Where is the sense to Finnegan's Wake? Where is it? Why does it start here, end there, but doesn't it end, it doesn't have a beginning? Should it? Well, to some people, yes. But this was not.
But when did Joyce get the idea? What inspired him to make a book like that? What?
Through going to a pub. Have you heard of a pub?
Right, was that in Zurich during World War I? Where you'd hear many languages of exiles.
That helped. Oh, yes. But do you realize, if you're in a pub and there's a cacophony, there's people talking, there's people shouting, there's people playing cards, there's some playing darts, there's some playing dominoes, there's some playing drafts, take your pick. Yet you can still hear the person opposite you somewhat. But what if it's, you're talking with a person sitting across from you, and there's a conversation to your left, and you're listening to both conversations because the one to the left is also interesting. What are you doing when you do that? You see?
Right. Now, you used the metaphor of a telephone party line as a main guiding image in writing Finnegan's Wake.
Yes.
But that was a technological version of the pub.
Yes.
And you thought you were interested in what that would do to the pub keepers, to the pub inhabitants when they had that electrically.
Yes.
So that's where you were overlaying the original pub situation plus technological new ground that was coming.
Yes.
All right, I'd like to move away from this topic and appreciate that. And I don't know if there was one more question. Let's just move on to, let's think. I'd like to talk to Frank Zappa now. Can we have him there?
Yes.
So we wait a minute while Ellie, Michael's wife, turns over the tape, and I'll start again.
Please continue.
Now, Frank, I spoke to you in March 14th, 1985, in your studio on Woodrow Wilson Drive. And I mentioned Finnegan's Wake to you, and you said, I don't know why that was ever published. Before I ask my question, do you have anything to say about that comment, since you're listening, I assume, to Joyce and McLuhan talking here?
Not why, was it about that? How could it be published? Who would publish it?
Why would that be an issue for you?
If you do something that is not as people expect something, then the media is blamed as well as the artist. And to prevent media from being blamed, media is then censoring. Media censors against media being blamed. So, not why, but how could that be published? It now is considered a classic. And those who would print or reprint are not held up against a wall and shot. But whenever you do something that is not expected, then media oftentimes gets the blame.
Right. Now, so you were impressed by the people that published that.
Oh, yes.
Now, you have a phrase in your first album. First of all, do you remember me?
Oh, yes.
Remember me talking to you in 85 about Finnegan's
Yes.
Wake?
Yes.
Yeah, I misinterpreted that you were not interested in it. I didn't pursue it that way. Now, in your first album, you have the concept of the monster magnet. Is the monster magnet, at the time, were you thinking of the electronic vortex, electronic reality, media that you as a musician had to contend with?
Yes, and there's more to it than that.
Can you tell me some more?
What is the movement to be unplugged? What does it mean? If you would see that various artists would present themselves in the past several years as unplugged. Unplugged from what? Unplugged from the magnetic monster. They're saying that their individuality is being stressed by the very fact they're not a part of the electronic spin that everything is within. The irony of it, of course, and the obviousness of it, is that they record themselves unplugged, and what are they recording themselves on? But an electronic media. So they would go on improved electronic media, but they're saying they're unplugged. Not part of that magnetic draw that crushes everything. Now, if you take a good look at amplification, this is amplification. With amplification can come, not necessarily, but most times does, is loss of individual. It become then a morass of sound. There's the magnetic monster. There is no no individuality in amplification.
That's because the undifferentiated tissue phrase you use in the Grand Wazoo album.
Yes.
Yeah.
With that, a triangle, the drummer would strike a triangle, and that triangle would be as loud as the drums of the piano or the guitar. It's amplified far beyond its natural ability. Now, if you can make the ting of a triangle that, then you can make a piano as loud as an explosion. And if you can do that, then you can make the drums as loud as two explosions.
So these were the issues you were working on as a composer?
Yes.
The present-day composer refused to die in the world of amplification.
Yes.
These were the issues that are symbolized by the Monster Magnet and the Electric Aunt Jemima song title.
Yes.
Which
can you see that one of the things worked towards in the recordings we did was to show the individual within amplification. Could individual still exist within amplification? The answer is, eventually, it becomes something else. But as far as amplification is concerned, all things become amplified, and there is no differentiation. The small, quiet voice inside becomes amplified.
So where's the dwarf in that process, right?
Mm.
And these are the same issues that Joyce and Finnings Wake and McLuhan worked with.
Yes.
But you weren't aware, you didn't refer to them. You knew, you were working out on your own.
Yes, because this is another media. If you look at print media, if you take a specific example of print media, and this is deliberately chosen, print media on the internet, it's considered bad form to write in all capitals. It's the equivalent of shouting. So, that's a form of print media that says, stop shouting. Sound. Print. With that which we did was sound. But sound prints. There is a print of sound. There is the blue, the yellow, the red within sounds. But if all are red, then you cannot tell one from the other. It's all shouting.
Yes, and this is the this is what Pauline Oliveros' concept attracted you, the way she used music above and below consciousness.
Yes.
And then the undifferentiated mass. I want to move into, I understand, I think, unless you want to add one point about this.
Please.
On July 3rd, going into July 4th, 1997, I had a very strong dream with you, Frank. Did you visit me in that evening, that night?
Yes and no.
How is it yes, how is it no?
Yes to trigger it, no to continue it. It was yours after that. It was your dream.
Why were you triggering it?
Follow through on the dream and you'll see that that which is being said today is not entirely new to your ears.
Right, so you were saying something like that night.
Yes.
And I worked it out. Are you making music now?
No. Listening to much of it, yes. Listening to much of it.
On your dimension or in our dimension? In
this dimension, yours.
But you don't make music on your dimension.
No.
I'm talking about the personality Frank Zappa that continues after death.
Yes.
It doesn't.
No.
But it is thinking the way the personality did alive in response to what's happening here.
Yes.
I see. I'd like to move into a friend
point,
of you.
One point. It's not the music. It's the composition. The composition, the musicianship put together makes a particular statement. It's interesting to see the composition of music is steadily improving.
Right. So did you trigger my dream because you saw I was working on these issues? And
yes.
It's sort of a form of helping me?
Yes.
Right. Now, there was a friend of yours. I'd like to locate Tim Carey. Tim Carey. Do you see that on the list?
Oh, Timothy Carey.
Yes.
An actor. Timothy Carey, C-A-R-E-Y. He's born 1929, March 11th. Died 1994, May 11th. Timothy Carey.
Yes, we have that.
Now, I'd like to also locate Garrett Dean.
Okay,
same time.
Friend Bob. Garrett.
September 19 or 1907.
Garrett, G-A-R-E-T-T, D-E-A-N-E. Born 1907 in September. Died 1993, November 1st in Nova Scotia in Dartmouth. We think Garrett Dean.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, is Garrett Dean and Timothy Carey did not know each other personally in life, but Timothy Carey was a good friend of Frank and Jerry Fialka, and Garrett was a good friend of mine. I recently saw some footage of Timothy Carey, who I didn't know, and he struck me as a lively character like Garrett Dean. Am I introducing those two people now?
Yes.
They would not have interacted on your dimension yet. I mean, before.
No.
All right, now that they're meeting, can they, in their state, in that dimension, see a lot of their lives and personalities quite...
Yes.
More than we can between people.
Yes, absolutely.
So I had the idea that since they both were great improvising actors, could they improvise a dialogue with entertainment as a goal for me and whoever hears this tape now? How would these two lively, edgy personalities, eccentric personalities, interact right now if they put us all on and did that right now? Could the Evergreens communicate this?
To say would be a little difficult. So using a little difficult as a baseline.
Yes.
They're bantering about little difficulties. Bantering about they're talking anecdotes. They're talking about trying to find an unoccupied bathroom.
An unoccupied bathroom.
When you've got to go, and the hostess says it's down the hall and somebody's already in it. One of life's little difficulties.
The farting issue that Tim Carey emphasized.
It's either stand there and jump on one foot on the other, or fart. Sometimes you may want to fart and don't fart, and you have a problem. One of life's little difficulties.
Yes.
They talk about little difficulties. It would be difficult to put this as a routine because they've not worked it out.
Right, but they have picked the key issue that Tim Carey was about, which was about farting. I don't know if Garrett was into farting, but they have got to the nub of the problem.
Yes.
And maybe their eccentric personalities were due to how to deal with little difficulties.
Yes.
And they thought they perhaps tried to twerk people's attitudes about little difficulties.
Yes.
There's the common thing between them.
Yes, they can see that. There are so many little difficulties.
Yes. Okay, I'd like to ask Timothy Carey, for his son, which project would he like to recommend that Romeo look into? The project called Al, or the project Necrophilia, or to continue with the insect trainer, maybe to make it as a film, or to present it again as a play?
The first one?
Al, it was called.
The first one, his reply is, Al, no, you can never reach him when you want to. The second?
Necrophilia.
He says it's a dying subject. Stay away from it. Third?
Insect trainer.
If it bugs you enough, do it.
What did Timothy Carey think of the performance? Think of the performance of the insect trainer in the summer of 1996 in L.A.
It's funny.
And it's on tape, so it remains funny.
Yes, but it's funny. It meets all the requirements of funny. So stay with funny. The first one's good, the second one's good, but the insect trainer is funny. Not the other two aren't, but this is funny.
And insect trainer, you were happy the way Romeo put it on?
Yes.
All right.
It's funny. It can be made longer, and it can be full of other things within itself, of course. But the premise is funny. The execution is funny.
The execution?
Yes, it's funny.
Yes. Addressing Timothy Carey and Frank Zappa, was Timothy Carey a bigger influence on Frank than Frank would admit when he was alive?
In many ways, yes.
Who's saying that?
Us.
Frank would agree.
Frank would agree. But you see, Timothy Carey had one ability to, whenever Frank got a little too esoteric, there's always a good fart joke. Always is. Not to puncture, not to diminish, but to bring Frank more aligned with where Frank wants to go. Whatever Frank would want to do, there has to be a practical application of it somewhere.
And that's what Frank learned from Tim?
Yes.
I see, yeah.
But realize, what he also learned from Tim was what is funny. Sometimes a fart is funny. What is a musical fart? There is a whole segment of music called surprise music that is known by certain musicians as fart music because people laugh. They don't know why they laugh when they hear the music, but it's fart music. You see, it's sometimes called that way.
Right. I mean, Captain Beefheart had a song called Old Fart to Play. Frank used to ask the musical question, does humor belong in music? He was basically asking about where's the fart interact with sound?
Yes. Where's music? Where's the musical fart? Why do people laugh at farts? Why do people laugh at fart jokes? Because of embarrassment? Most often not. Do people listen to music and chuckle when they hear music? Music is not words that would trigger sensations within the sound that would cause laughter. How can a person laugh at a sound of music? But they do. Approximately 1 minute.
So the idea of the world's greatest sinner, which was the film Timothy Carey made and is known for, was Frank acting at wondering what was the world's greatest sinner, or acting out some of the concepts he got from working on that film?
Worked them out from the concepts of the film.
That's where the big influence was.
Yes.
And now we come into Adolf Hitler. Was he, if he's immediately locatable for this short duration?
No.
He's not at this point.
But we can't help.
You can help?
Yes.
Was he the world's greatest sinner?
know. One of the causes of the great number of deaths, but not the greatest sinner. Up there among the top ten, yes, but not the world's greatest sinner.
Can you name the world's greatest sinner?
It would make no impact to the name.
Well,
but
what did he or she do?
And so the greatest sinner of them all was what is that name? All the men were murdered and all the women and children taken. And this was a Roman. I cannot give you the name. It is not important. But the sin was that there was no mercy. And in that, it's not the numbers killed. Though that within itself is terrible. But where there is no mercy, that is where there's sin.
The coldness, you mean?
The coldness of no mercy.
Of the attitude of the person directing that.
Yes.
Grace, is there someone who's been a great sinner, I say meaning a person who's done this across many lives?
No.
Okay.
No, with individual action, while alive.
Did the person then have to pay karma or have to realize they had?
Oh, yes, indeed.
But I get the feeling there's not karma unless there's a decision made to act on it between deaths, between lives.
You see, karma is not retributive.
Yeah.
But karma within itself is incredibly ironic. Incredibly. That person that killed almost 3,000 men, arbitrarily drawing the line between child and man, with no mercy, none of any. That person, upon death, his karma was that he would then aid people and realize the sanctity of mercy.
In several lives?
In several lives. Not to exculpate the mercilessness of himself in that life, but that he would learn that of all, mercy is the greatest of all saintlinesses that can exist. And now this must end.
Thank you.
Thank you. So unless there's any further comments, shall we end the session?
Please.
Thank you. Dear Lord, please enfold these entities in my love and my affection. Amen. Please clear any negative influences from these entities now.
Done.
Allow the body to become completely relaxed. Perform any healing which may need to be performed. Begin increasing the blood pressure to normal naturally. And begin returning all other systems of the body to normal naturally now.
Then.
And thank you for our sessions and prayer the room.
We do thank you.
Thank you.
To you both. God's blessing.
Thank you, Evergreen. Same to you. Now I would like Michael to awaken, feeling completely refreshed, relaxed, and loved now.
Came out of that session. Marshall McLuhan said to me in that session, and I've got to check this out as a fact, but the Bible was the first book printed on the printing press in the West. And that legitimized printing. And it didn't, there was a little bit of, there was a hassle about being able to print this, but nonetheless, in a way, it legitimized printing. The second book printed was a cookbook. Now, what McLuhan said was the sale of the Bible from the printing press, from Gutenberg and Claxton and all of those. They went because everybody bought a Bible. great marketing decision on the part of the printer, you know, because you can't go wrong selling Bibles. Still a, you know, huge selling book today. So you can't go wrong printing Bibles. But the second one, being a cookbook, caused people to do things. And McLuhan says it's interesting. The cookbook, printing of the cookbook, went out and people had recipes that they tried that previously were written down and passed around. But this brought out more recipes and spread more recipes. And McLuhan says, next to the Bible, cookbooks are the biggest selling books you can get. Why? Because they give you recipes. And they're beautiful sequential things. You do this, 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 and you will end up with this. Guaranteed, every time.
That's linear.
That's linear.
Linearity. It has a linear content. A
linear content.
Enhanced by the linearity medium.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, finnick plague is a big cook. It's a stew.
It's
a big metaphor in the wake.
Yeah, it's a goulash. Now, the thing is that McCullough was saying about film, and saying film has the ability to have double exposure. You can have two exposures on one piece of film, and you can have one in the foreground, one in the background, and you can gain sense from both of them simultaneously. Television being such a hot medium.
A cool medium.
Is hot at you. It's got all of, you know, you see, when you see Sandy Van Ocker in front of the Capitol building, a lot is given in that picture.
Yeah.
Picture worth a thousand words. Yes, but it's more than that.
TV became a hot medium on the content level. It wasn't in the 50s, but now it's fine detail and high definition.
Very. Now, I keep on thinking of a friend of ours in Moscow. His name is Nikolai. I mean, it sounds stereotypical, but his name is Nikolai, and his wife is Vera. And about the time that the Soviet Union was slowly collapsing out and Russia was beginning to emerge, they went to a lot of movies. They loved American movies, and they were dubbed, and they liked American movies. Nikolai went because he so enjoyed the action. He loved shooting police movies and all that kind of thing. And Vera liked some of the romantic movies, and because she was quite a romantic lady. But he found out that she used to go to the movies because she used to like to see the kitchens.
Yeah.
And she used to look at me and say, oh, they got a stove. They got a look at the size of the refrigerator. And Nikolai thinks, I'm trying to listen. And she's saying, look at the drain board. Double sink. That's what we have to get next. So that's the thing. She saw the context of the movie was for her not what the front frame was.
Right. She saw the background. So how's that related to what McLuhan was saying about film?
Saying that film is so manipulable that you don't realize that you are being manipulated by film or by video or that. People can hear in a voice whether a person's telling a truth or a lie or whining.
More than the person realizes, right?
More than the person. Yeah, exactly.
The acoustic sensitivity is in high definition, isn't it?
Yeah.
Our intuitive factor.
Mm-hmm. And we've trained that across centuries, we are hearing things we don't hear like dogs, but we don't hear as dogs. No.
So we were ready to take advantage of radio and TV when it came along.
When it came in, it just brought it in. A fascinating thing was, what happens when you cross a radio set with a telephone and you end up with cellular phones? Do you end up with a new technology or an extension of both? Now, what happens with cellular phones, that cellular phones go so widespread that everybody has a cellular phone, but we don't need phones anymore.
Yeah.
Television did not wipe out radio. Everybody said that the picture and the combination of that and sound wiped out radio. It didn't. Radio flourished afterwards because radio could offer something that television couldn't. Even though television could offer something that radio couldn't. But what next? We start combining two more technologies but we don't even think it could be connected. And it could be, they took anything from the land.
Take a
microwave.
And a car.
A car. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So we end up with cars are powered by microwaves or something like that.
That's what they were talking about.
Yeah, radar detectors, but I'm saying that the concepts of microwave that we put into the concept of car, and we end up with a whole new thing that we didn't have before. And that's just joining two things we know.
That's what McLuhan was talking about. That makes sense, what he was saying. He was trying to, what is going to be combined? What's this new thing? What are these, actually, these new things which are neither telephone or car or microwave, right?
Yeah. And how that creates an environment that our whole thinking shifts and changes.
So you remember that thought fascinating you as you were dreaming this.
Oh, yes, very much so. McLuhan didn't look as thin as I remember him as. He looked, he'd filled out a little. He looked...
An older McLuhan.
Older, just a little more fleshed out. He looked a little bit more... Well, quite frankly, he looked quite healthy.
And you don't know why?
I don't know why.
Did you see Joyce or Lewis?
No, I didn't see Joyce. I rarely see him. But this guy... There were three people together, and I know one of them. I don't know who the other two were. One was Frank Zappa. The second guy was a comedian.
Timothy Carey.
Okay, and the third one I don't know.
That was Garrett Dean, probably. We brought in Garrett, old friend.
Okay. Somebody suggested to them that they put their heads together and do a routine.
Oh, to all three or those two? To all three or
to
the
all
two?
To all three.
Right.
And somebody said, I think it was this person I didn't know, said, that's a little difficult. So Frank said, well, that's our theme. It's a little difficult. And the second guy says, yeah, like trying to prevent a fart when you can't. And they said, oh, that's one of the little difficulties. And they were going to get little difficulties. And they were cracking up some of the little difficulties, you know. One of the biggest little difficulties is when you're at a party and you really got to pee.
Yeah.
And you go down the hall to the left where you were directed and you find the door and it's locked and you got to go. And there's nowhere else to go.
That's
incredible. You can't go out in the yard and pee because it's not your yard.
Now, were you laughing as they did this?
I was looking at those were just the two examples that they gave. And they said, because it was going to take a little time to get this thing heated up and get going. But Zappa said, you're going to have, yeah, okay. Our little difficulty is the title. He said, that's it. Now, this is what he used to do with the...
Take the immediate... Now, that's incredible, because Tim Carey is well known about farting. He wrote he took Daly's essay on farting. He made a whole movie, a whole play of The Insect Trainer. You won't believe when his son hears this, that it's about... that he picked the farting, and that Zappa picked up on the Garrett just saying something normal.
Yeah.
That's what Zappa would take it, what people said, and tape and mutate it, make something out of it.
Yeah.
And then Carey was himself.
Yeah, and that was also something interesting to me. That Frank Zappa was saying, the big thing towards unplugged from what? He says, when you're recording it in a big studio with lots of musicians, you're unplugged? He says, no, you're unplugged.
This is phase three. First phase one.
The audience sits inside of a big piano and they listen to it grow.
People are going to sit inside of a piano. They're going to listen to this piano grow.
They're going to listen to the piano grow.
Listen.
It's going to turn into
something. It's going to turn into another Haight Ashbury. Remember how we commercialized on that scene?
That was a really good move.
Right, Nanny. All it was like people sitting in doorways freaking out tourists going, merry-go-round, merry-go-round, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And they called that doing their thing.
Oh, yeah. That's what doing your thing is.
The thing is to put a motor in yourself.